Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting in Seattle, Washington, with the Center for Science and Culture of the Discovery Institute. We have on our show with us today, once again, Mr. Michael Flannery, author of Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism, published by Erasmus Press. The website is www.erasmuspress.net. A little bit about Mr. Flannery. Michael Flannery is professor and associate director for historical collections at the Lister Hill Library of Health Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He's originally from Cincinnati, Ohio, and he holds two master's degrees, one in library science from the University of Kentucky and another in history from California State University, Dominguez Hills. He's also quite a writer. He's written seven books, and in 2001, he won the prestigious Edward Kramer's Award for Distinguished Writing by an American from the American Institute of the History of Pharmacy, and he also won the 2006 Publications Award for the Archivists and Librarians in the History of Health Sciences. His latest book is, again, Alfred Russel Wallace's Theory of Intelligent Evolution, How Wallace's World of Life Challenged Darwinism, and he's written on this topic of Alfred Russel Wallace in the not-so-distant past. This past February 2009, actually in honor of Darwin Day, or Darwin's 200th birthday, he published a piece in Forbes magazine online titled Alfred Russel Wallace, where he made the case that we need to really take Alfred Russel Wallace seriously. Not only is he the co-discoverer of the theory of natural selection, but he also is an early progenitor of intelligent design thinking. In the first couple podcasts, we've talked about Darwin and Wallace, how they compared, why we need to take Wallace out of being in Darwin's shadow and look at their historical context and understand the importance of Wallace's intellectual contributions. So I'd really like to get into, in this podcast with Michael Flannery, talking about Wallace's actual intelligent design views, how his intelligent design was like modern ID, how it was different, and why Wallace is really important as a thinker within the history of intelligent design. So, Michael Flannery, thank you again for coming on the podcast with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, we left off last time talking about the class differences between Darwin and Wallace and how that affected their respective ideas. I want to jump into right now a little bit about Wallace's views on Darwinism and his views on intelligent design. So first I'd like to start off talking about Wallace's views of design. And I was reading your book actually a couple days ago before this podcast and was reading how Wallace was discussing the incredible properties of water and how water allows us to have life on the earth, how water is unique in that it actually expands as it freezes, which allows ice to float, which prevents the oceans obviously from freezing from the bottom up. And this is very important for the existence of life on this planet. And all of these unique properties felt like I was reading something by a modern intelligent design proponent talking about the fine tuning of the laws of physics and chemistry and also cosmology to point towards intelligent design. So did Wallace see design only in biology or also in cosmology and physics?
Well, he saw design in the universe really as evidently as he saw it in the world of life. He discusses actually this in some detail in an earlier book that was published in 1903 that he wrote called Man's Place in the Universe. It's in many ways not dissimilar from Guillermo Gonzalez and Jay Richards' Privileged Planet. Wallace outright rejects the unfortunately misnamed Copernican principle. You know, that's the notion that humans are not specially privileged observers of the universe or that the Earth holds a special or unique place in it. This, by the way, it's misnamed because Copernicus really never suggests anything of the sort. Anyway, in Man's Place in the Universe, Wallace states exactly the opposite, that our place in the Milky Way, the precise properties of our sun, the planetary arrangement, the forces of gravity, our moon, the exacting tolerances of light, temperature, and all the requisite minerals, all are necessary for life, and that this suggests that we are most likely alone, and that these all suggest sort of a grand design expressly leading toward life. Now, you're right, Wallace spends considerable time in the world of life, in particular in Chapter 7, where he's examining the basic elements, particularly carbon and water, all requisite to life. And many materialists and positivists want to say that all the remarkable features of the cosmos are the product of chance operations working through infinity. In other words, given enough time, they'll say that anything can happen, but Wallace really dismisses this notion that an eternal universe removes the problems of creation and existence. existence by saying that the postulate of a past eternal existence is no explanation at all and leads to what he calls insuperable difficulties. A beginning in time for all finite things, he said, is demonstrable, but beginning implies an antecedent cause. And one has to say, with the Big Bang of approximately 13.7 or so billion years ago, appears to have confirmed, you know, Wallace's argument here. At any rate, Wallace never thought that the materialism that was inherent in Darwinism explained very much. I mean, sure, you could see variation and adaptation at work, but what about true origins? What about the beginning of life? What about the nature of man? Wallace never attacked Darwin directly, but it's important to understand that he did attack the essence of Darwin's theory through the leading purveyors of the ism that bears his name, especially Thomas Huxley and Ernst Haeckel.
So in what way was Wallace a skeptic of true Darwinism?
The main thing that gave him the most problems, I think, was the conclusion that all things were explicable through natural selection. In fact, the limitation of Darwinian processes, Wallace saw through the principle of utility, and that is that no morphological feature will appear or be used by a species unless it is of use to it. Darwin took a look at that principle of utility and then said, well, if natural selection operates by this principle of utility, that is the idea that features and attributes of species must be of use in the survival of that species, then what explains the tremendous intellect of mankind? And he felt that that principle of utility was utterly incapable of explaining the higher properties of the human mind. And he used specific examples, wit, music, the aesthetic sense, mathematics, higher reasoning, metaphysics, all of those things that are clearly attributes that make us distinctively human, he felt was simply inexplicable by the principle of utility that he felt was intrinsic to the operation of natural selection. So really, he diverged from Wallace most significantly over that one point.
What was the idea of the vital force, and did Wallace promote it?
Well, let's define what vital force is, first of all. It can often be related to the term vitalism. It's a belief that living organisms cannot be completely described or understood through physical or chemical properties alone. Now, you might presume that this suggests some form of theism, and often it does, but it doesn't necessarily follow. Some have argued that vitalism or a vital force suggests that life is self-determining. Nevertheless, it's had a long tradition in the history of science, dating from antiquity. Many important figures in science and medicine appealed to a vital force in their own work. Paracelsus in the early 1500s, the great iatrochemist who gave us the beginnings of medicinal chemistry, wrote about an archeus or a spark of life. Francois Magendie in the late 18th, early 19th century, the great French physiologist and pioneer of experimental pharmacology, assumed a vital force. Now, closer to Wallace's time, the Austrian botanist Anton Kerner and the famous German physician and founder of cellular pathology, Rudolf Virchow, believed in vital force or vital force of life. And Lionel Smith Beale wrote an elaborate counter to Thomas Huxley's mechanistic manifesto on the nature of protoplasm, which expounded on the theory of vital force in 1870. Now, perhaps the most significant discussion of vital force was offered by Henry Bergson in his Creative Evolution, which was, of course, he was French. It was published in French in 1907 and then translated around 1911, I believe. And now to him, the diversity of life had a deeper sense, an élan vital, he called it. And Bergson points out that things like human intuition are constituent capacities of the universe. This intuitive sense works in all things in a process of becoming, and in his words, gives us a consciousness of a vital impulse, this élan vital within us. Now, if all of this sounds rather vague and mystical, Wallace thought so too. In his World of Life, he discusses Anton Kerner's vital force as well as Haeckel's mechanistic cell soul and the notion that life is a self-organizing, self-determining phenomenon. He writes, none of these verbal suggestions go to the root of the matter, and neither life nor vital force nor the unconscious cell soul are adequate explanations. Wallace reiterates this in a revealing letter, I think, to, and other people have not cited this. I'm a little surprised by that. But there's a revealing letter to the Oxford zoologist Edward Poulton in May of 1912, roughly a year before his death. Poulton had apparently queried Wallace about his thoughts on a paper that he had written on Henry Bergson and Charles Darwin. And Wallace's response made it clear that he didn't think Bergson's élan vital was much of any value whatsoever. Wallace admitted he hadn't read Bergson, apparently found what he knew of his ideas pretty unconvincing. He admitted that Bergson had some things in common with his own views, but he went on to insist that, in his words, all vague ideas, such as an internal development force, seemed to him of no real value as an explanation in nature. He thought Bergson's ideas were pretty unconvincing. He rejected the notion of a law of sympathy that Bergson had talked about in favor of a supreme mind that worked by and through and not in primal forces of nature by means of natural selection. So he was not a vitalist. He was not a proponent of the vital force. I will say that Martin Fickman, who has written an otherwise excellent biography of Wallace called The Elusive Victorian, suggests that Wallace adhered to some form of process theology. Well, process theology, of course, didn't really come along until Alfred North Whitehead in the 20s, and of course, by then, Wallace was gone. But an immediate sort of intellectual predecessor to process thinking, and one that Whitehead himself acknowledged, was that of Bergson. And that is why I reject Fickman's claim there, because it's clear to me in his letter to Poulton that he really didn't think much of this Bergson-esque type of thinking.
You say in your book that, quote, all things considered, Wallace's intelligent evolution cannot be viewed as a blueprint for modern ID. Wallace simply did not have those 21st century tools available. What he did have was an openness to inquiry and a belief that science could and indeed did encompass more than the reductionist formulations of the Darwinists. Intelligent evolution is not so much a blueprint as it is a preamble to ID that seeks to set a perspective and a mindset of open inquiry. Unquote. But then you later go on to say that, quote, Wallace's legacy is best seen today as the seminal figure in the modern ID movement. The details of the designer or designers are less important here than the fact that he saw not only design in biological life in the universe, but that he framed his arguments in similar ways to leading ID researchers today. Wallace was a prescient figure. Wallace may have come a century too soon for Michael Behe's Irreducible Complexity, William Dembski's Specified Complexity, and Denise O'Leary and Mario Beauregard's analysis of the spiritual nature of the human brain, but he assuredly was their prophet, unquote. So how should we understand Wallace in light of these comments?
Well, obviously, we can't make Wallace have the same sensibilities and the same approach to intelligent design questions as they are being addressed today. I think we have to be sensitive to the history here. We should not see him as we would the modern ID leaders today. I mean, it's really unfair and unhistorical to judge Wallace by the standards of, let's say, William Dembski's statistics and information theory, or Michael Behe's molecular biology, or Mario Beauregard, or Michael Egner's neuroscience. So if we find flaws in some of his formulations, even Darwinists have to admit that their own namesake's belief in the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which he developed into a, quite frankly, a bizarre theory of pangenesis, was absolute poppycock. Wallace surely couldn't have understood modern ID any more than William Harvey's De Motu Cordis, that first described the function of the heart in 1628, could have understood myocardial infarction, or any more than we should expect Louis Pasteur to have invented penicillin. In this context, I think we have to see Wallace as a figure living more than a century ago who took the latest ideas of science, even contributing in that regard, and drawing one fundamental conclusion, that certain features of the universe and of living things are best explained by an intelligent cause, and that an undirected natural selection was an inadequate explanation for many aspects, in fact, many key aspects of biological life. And I think that's how we should see Wallace, and if we put him in that context, he does indeed become a progenitor for the current modern movement.
So, Mr. Flannery, who is Charles Smith, who you write about in your book, and why is he so opposed to the notion that Wallace supported ID, that he must resort to conflating ID with creationism, and claim that the argument that Wallace has some connections to ID thinking is only made by the, quote, agenda-driven, unquote? What do his comments reveal about his own bias and his own viewpoint?
Well, Smith's a professor and a librarian at Western Kentucky University who's made a life study of Wallace. And I really have to say, before I address these issues, that his Alfred Russel Wallace page on the web is a huge and rich resource for those interested in Wallace. It really is just an outstanding website. The most useful aspect is that Smith has posted many of Wallace's original writings to the site, making them available full text. So it's a great tool. It's a great resource for scholars. And I have to tip my librarian's cap to Smith. He's done an outstanding job in that regard. That said, it's clear that Smith developed his own views on Wallace. And, you know, if you go to his FAQ page, he has the question posed, did Wallace believe in intelligent design? And he says, and I'll just quote from it here, no, no, and no. I guess one no wasn't enough for him. Assuming that ID essentially amounts to nothing more than a new name for creationism, that is. Don't fall for the facile understanding being promoted by some agenda-driven observers who argue that just because Wallace was a spiritualist and believed that higher intelligence were influencing events here on Earth, that he also believed in miraculous, non-law-based kinds of godly intervention, end quote. Well, that's Smith's statement on Wallace and ID, and I think this is absolutely, completely wrong. Maybe it's because the good professor just doesn't know what ID really is. I don't know. We've been over this before, but ID, of course, is not creationism. If the standard for ID is simply that some features of the natural world are best explained by an intelligent cause, and that indeed is what every major ID scientist and theorist has ever argued that I know of, then Wallace meets the test hands down. But Smith's problem, I think, goes deeper than simply a misunderstanding of what ID actually is. It's clear Smith has a false notion of miracles. After all, why assume that miracles even require so-called non-law-based kinds of godly intervention Smith ascribes to them? There's really no reason to assume that a miracle requires natural laws to be suspended in some fanciful abracadabra moment of direct godly intervention. I mean, we have to remember that the root meaning of miracles is simply something wondrous. It's not necessary to presume that certain laws in nature that would have behaved one way need to be spontaneously short-circuited, causing an entirely different result in order to have a miracle. This is not necessary for ID because there's no reason to assume that the designer, whatever we call it, whether it's God, angels, subordinate beings, or an overruling intelligence, cannot work through natural laws and indeed turn an otherwise random action into one of purposeful intent. Let me do this by way of a simple example. There's some archaeologists looking at the area where the Red Sea was allegedly parted, and they believe it was caused by earthquake activity. Okay, but does this natural explanation remove the wondrous or miraculous nature of the event permitting the Jewish people to escape Pharaoh and at the same time destroy their pursuer's army? Well, of course it doesn't. The timing, the concatenation of circumstances, and the instrumentality of that earthquake for the Jewish people remains by all measures miraculous. Again, miracles can clearly work by and through natural principles, laws, and phenomena. This is precisely the argument that's made by Wallace. Wallace objected to materialists who a priori ruled out miracles because they broke natural laws. I mean, who are we to suggest how nature is to act? Now, Smith tried to buttress his claim that Wallace was not a theist by citing an 1871 collection of Wallace essays, Contributions to the Theory of Natural Selection, in which, it's true, Wallace clearly states that he did not believe in first causes. And this is typically defined as the God did it cause. And he did not believe that first causes could be invoked for anything in the universe. Well, that's true. But that's not because there isn't the first cause. Whether we call it an overruling intelligence or an infinite being or God or whatever, it's certainly not that Wallace is arguing against the first cause in this sense. It's simply that he sees the creative and life processes in nature as being subordinately directed by whatever you want to call them, spirits, angels, entities, or what have you. So what Wallace was arguing against was that first causes could be detected directly in nature because there were all these to his way of thinking, subordinate entities working between the first cause and those specific phenomena in nature. So I think Smith needs to carefully reconsider his position here, but I wouldn't belabor the point. I would simply ask listeners in the audience to get a copy of my book and read for themselves what Wallace has to say about it and make up their own mind. Is my position more reasonable given Wallace's statements, or are Smith's statements? And I think a fair and full reading of Wallace's own comments will clearly bear me out.
Well, you note in your book, Mr. Flannery, that some will resist associating Wallace with ID because he goes too far in inferring intelligent design, and others because he doesn't go far enough. So what's the proper role of Wallace with respect to ID?
Well, I see Wallace as an important naturalist who not only developed a theory in many respects similar to Darwin's, but also in some very important respects different. It's in those differences that he came to see a theory of intelligently designed evolution, and that's a good deal what I talk about in my introduction about what I call intelligent evolution. Now, just as ID has no general opposition to evolution per se, the real question is, what do we mean when we say evolution? Are we talking about Darwin's random and chance, absolutely restricted to a positivistic scientism, a materialist worldview, or are we talking about an evolution of a different kind, the kind Wallace first talked about in a modern context, an evolution imbued with design? Now, let's be careful not to get confused here. This isn't theistic evolution of the Ken Miller variety, where you assume all of Darwin's materialistic premises and then simply build in a sort of divine add-on. There, you're really just trying to fit a square peg, I think, into a round hole. That is, you're trying to fit theism into a theory for which Darwin never intended. In intelligent evolution, the kind that Wallace discussed, you're talking really about common descent in which natural selection, at least a wholly naturalistic natural selection, is strictly limited. And it is in those limits that intelligent design come out most clearly. Again, we have to be careful not to ascribe to Wallace things he couldn't possibly have known about modern molecular biology. But if I find a strong kindred spirit in the modern ID movement, I mean, I'd have to say it's probably Michael Behe. Behe accepts common descent and the limited power of natural selection, but has persuasively argued that random mutation, the source of really all that is novel and important in Darwin's theory, is completely unable to explain significant aspects of the biological world. Behe has, if you will, developed a much more sophisticated, a much more rigorous, intelligent evolution, and moreover, his most recent book, The Edge of Evolution, clearly delineates where the line between randomness and design can be drawn. Wallace was unable to call upon the scientific tools of Behe a century ago, and I think he had some trouble discerning that line. But he still developed a theory of evolution inherently opposed to Darwin's that, like Behe's, insisted that Darwinian mechanisms of chance and mere utility were incapable of explaining everything in nature. I think Wallace demonstrates very clearly that the battle lines described by Darwinists and, frankly, most of the mass media are really simply wrong. The problem isn't between evolution and science versus creationism and religion. The problem is between two different kinds of science, a science premised upon metaphysical materialism, strictly ruling out a priori, the possibility of intelligent design, and a different kind of science, a science premised upon the inherently allowable consideration of intelligent design. And this is really a battle between scientists. It's a battle also taking place at worldview levels. So I think that's how we should see Wallace today.
Well, Mr. Flannery, I think for our listeners who want to hear some striking descriptions in Wallace's book, The World of Life, talking about biological features that point to an intelligent design, read his description of the feather and his description of the cell as well. Even though it was a rudimentary understanding at that time, his description of cellular division and, as I said, his description of the feather are really quite striking and I think provide an excellent example of how he saw design in biology. So this is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Stay tuned for more with Michael Flannery talking about Alfred Russel Wallace.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.